I wanted to just take some time to do a little bit of a roundtable. John and I are going to host this. He's got two speakers over there, Glenn and David, which we've heard from today. And we're going to bring Parazide from DarkFi back with us. Could we go ahead and get Parazide and everybody back up here? And the title of this panel is simply, can digital technology really lead to privacy and liberty, right? Maybe some of you guys have been thinking this as you've been hearing these different projects. Like, okay, that sounds great, but it's still on the internet, right? It's still, somebody's going to be able to intercept that signal somewhere, right? There's a lot of confusion and maybe misunderstanding and maybe even some naivete. Maybe some of us are naive in some ways in thinking digital technology can save us or help us. But I want to see if we can answer that question or at least get some interesting thoughts out with this panel. So maybe we could just start there, John, and see where that leads with that general question of the panel and just pose that to our panelists. Can digital technology, Glenn works on privacy tools, David's working with laptops and privacy, securing people in that way, Parazide and the DarkFi team are really trying to create anonymous infrastructure. Let's start with that. I'll go to Parazide first. Can these digital tools truly lead to privacy and liberty, or more specifically, can they actually protect our privacy and our liberty?
Okay. I actually really think so, because like when we use these privacy tools, it allows us to build to make counter economics, so we can build our own markets, free markets, which is something physical. So I think using this technology also will help us in away from keyboard as well.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. I'd like the mention of counter economics for sure.
Well, I think definitely we need to take the effort to get private, and getting private is definitely a step to getting free. Like I said, I mean, privacy and freedom are very much connected, and a lot of people that are in the freedom community talk freedom, but they don't talk privacy, and I think we need to talk about both. That being said, I mean, there's a You can go so far down the rabbit hole with this that you can just live your life. Just all I want to do is get private. I mean, there's a balance that you have to find, and that's where, you know, I think the further you go down this, the more comfortable you get with getting private and using the tools that you can get private. And so it's not like you jump in and you just go all the way in. I think just do what you can. Take a step. And because if you go too far into this, it's going to get overwhelming very quickly. I mean, there is a lot to know. So just don't worry about the whole diving deep into this. Do what you can now. Take another step.
How about you, David? Yeah, I really like two concepts here when it comes to privacy. One, this idea, this metaphor of privacy sort of begins at the front door of your home, right, in the physical space. So anything that you would do in your home is your private business, you and your family, and there's no reason for anyone else to know what's happening inside that home. Same thing with your home network. So anything that you want to keep private can stay within your home network, and that is actually pretty easy to keep secure. As long as you're not, you know, broadcasting it out across the internet, then you can keep that private. And the other idea that I really like is privacy by default, right? So instead of by default all your metadata being shared, all of your private information being shared when you access a website or make a search or whatever, why not start using tools that actually respect that privacy by default? And then optionally, if you wanted to share data, say for example, say you use fitness tracking with a smartwatch or something like that, if you wanted to optionally share anonymized health data that might be useful to researchers, then you should be able to optionally provide that anonymized data. And realistically, you should even be paid for that. You should be given micropayments for the exchange of that valuable research data. And these are things that we think about a lot, and that that are coming sort of a little bit further down the line, but they're not as far away as we may think.
Yeah, I got a question for Paris D. Great answers, by the way. It's Paris D, right? Paris D.
Anything's fine.
Anything's fine. Just a humble programmer. What do you think about Ethereum? What are your thoughts on Ethereum, the project and the blockchain?
Just in general?
In general, yes. Well, when it comes to the privacy and counter economics.
Yeah, I have different concerns and different good things. The way it's moving, it just feels like it's becoming something state-induced, and there's a lot of surveillance going on. So I noticed many projects are building these new things, and they're saying, oh, yeah, we're going to scale using zero-knowledge proofs and various things. But there's also a fake narrative of promising fake security and privacy. But it's important to note that Ethereum is not doing anything actually to remain private. And on the side, we have these layer twos, which are like Aztec Network and Starkware, which do give some kind of protection. But again, settling it back on the base layer, you lose all of your anonymity. So I don't think it's a good long-term solution.
Okay. Does anybody want to add anything else on that?
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. Ethereum's a really cool playground. They're coming up with some really cool ideas and working with some cool technologies that can be used elsewhere. I don't personally see it as money so much, and I definitely don't see it as a place to go to use money privately or to do smart contracting in a private way necessarily. So yeah, I would agree. And to see the links, the partnerships that are being made with some of some Ethereum adjacent institutions with you know, big banks, JP Morgan,
World Economic things like Forum. This.
Yeah, yeah. It's
there's even ties with the WEF as well.
Yeah. So I steer clear personally, and but you know, like I said, they are doing some cool experimentation, some cool computer science, but I don't trust it as money, nor as a place to be private.
Right on.
Yeah, I'll add to that, John, just real quick. Besides, as our guest here mentioned, the Ethereum Foundation is directly partnered with the people we're trying to counter. There's that element, but also the Ethereum Foundation is partnering with, I believe, I want to say Ethiopia. It's a government in Africa to do digital ID facial recognition on the blockchain through their, you know, through their system. So and of course that could be voluntary, but it seems to, as we heard, be more kind of state induced, state partnerships.
Yeah. You have projects like WorldCoin and Kleros, which try to use Ethereum as kind of digital justice, where you have a smart contract instead of a jury. WorldCoin is something that incentivizes people with giving them money to actually scan your eye as this digital ID that you mentioned. So there's like an orb, you put your eye in, you scan it, and you get money for it. So that's a very bad incentive.
Yeah, that sounds like trouble. That's New World Order. New World Order 2.0. I want to make a point on the digital ID blockchain thing, specifically referencing Cardano, which is another programmable blockchain, right? It makes it easy to write software and applications. And so I'm not sure Cardano is as nefarious as Ethereum. But I do want to say something that came to mind that I thought was an interesting perspective that we should all consider, put ourselves in other people's shoes. It was explained to me the digital ID or even having a blockchain ID in some of these developing African countries. You have to understand that a lot of these countries are going through dictatorship after dictatorship after dictatorship. And there's no record of property. A family or a couple generations could work their butts off to finally acquire some wealth or even a home or some property. And the next brutal dictator comes in and wipes it all away. Now, if there was some sort of immutable, which basically means unchangeable, record of property ownership, that could help to overcome that corruption. So I just want to throw that out there. I'm not advocating for digital ID, but we in the US and other areas, I don't want to use the P word, privilege, but we do experience a whole lot of freedom in our lives. One of our speakers before from Russia even used the word democracy, which I revolt from, right? But in Russia, they were a communist dictatorship not very long ago, just a few generations ago or a few decades ago. So just some things to consider when we're evaluating the stuff that's going on in this world. Just want to throw that out.
Let me add to that real quick, John. One thing, because you're right, as far as discussing Africa and really what's known as the Global South, which includes Mexico and Central and South America, where a lot of people are unbanked or have no ID. And to my Mexican friends in the audience and those who are going to hear this later, this is a part of the agenda, is to convince you that you need to join the system. And in fact, I see this a lot being in Texas on the other side of the river for those coming from Mexico, including Miriam's family who came to the U.S. to start a new life, where people see themselves as they're not legitimate until they get their ID or till they get their paperwork. Now I'm a real person because the whole society around them tells you you're undocumented, you're illegal, you're bad, all this stuff. So they work hard, they work hard. Then they finally get a driver's license and a business license. It teaches people that going into the system is where you'll get success. And what I've been trying to do is encourage both Mexicans and immigrants in the U.S. and Mexicans here to recognize that there's strength in being outside of the systems. And this is what counter-economics is all about, is recognizing that we're building a new counter-economy. So while it is true that, yes, there are problems with the, you know, keeping up with property, as John mentioned, in other situations where blockchain could be useful, we have to make sure that any of those technologies, which is what John's talking about, stay in the hands of the people. Because clearly we know if a blockchain that claims it's here to help, as they're trying to do, these poor African farmers and Mexican farmers who have no digital ID. Well, digital ID is a human right. That's sustainable development goal number 9. Got to make sure they have a digital ID so they can join the system. And it'll come with a digital wallet and all that fun stuff. So we can clearly see the danger in pushing that as well. If it's in the hands of the WEF or the governments, I don't think it's, we know it's not going to be private. We know it's going to be centralized and it's not going to lead to more liberty. So we need to be able to distinguish between that. Can people like the DarkFi team and others create infrastructure that allows us to keep track of property records and other things without governments? Because if so, that's a step in the direction of the world we're trying to create. But if it's in the hands of the governments and the World Economic Forum and their partners, then it's you'll own nothing and be happy. So we need to understand the difference.
100%.
We're going to do audience questions, Derek. You guys got any in Mexico?
Okay, privacy, yeah, we got
crypto technology. All right.
Come on down. We got one question, John, for our panel. Thank you guys for being here with us. Again, we know that some of these, feel free to come up. We got two questions here. We know some of these topics can be obscure or a little esoteric for some people, but we're trying to give you a wide range of information. Come on.
Thanks for all the information today, but I got at some point confused a little bit. For a while, I was wondering what channel should I use to communicate with my group, and there's a WhatsApp now, and then there's different option. And today we saw on the screen that probably the best option would be session and single. And then another speaker came after saying that single is financed by U.S. government, and same for I think was Tor. One says that Tor was the way, and then we hear the opposite. Can you guys agree?
I'll start this off. This is fun, though, right? Because in the tech space, you got a lot of difference of opinions. And it is true. Let's just establish the facts besides our opinions. Tor was funded by the U.S. government, branches of the U.S. government. For those who understand Tor, the onion router. Signal also received funding through the U.S. government, certain institutions. And now that's as far as we know. Now, does that mean those whole things are honeypots waiting to catch us? Many of us suspect so, myself and Ramiro and others. Do we have the evidence to 100% prove that? No, but I would recommend a book called Surveillance Valley. Surveillance Valley by a journalist named Yasha Levine, who did an amazing job researching all this. And the fact of the matter is Facebook, you know, nearly every major tool we use and even the internet itself was funded through the CIA's venture capital firm, NQTEL. To me, that's reason enough to be suspicious, but obviously we use the internet to broadcast truth messages of truth, right? So that is a fact. And you mentioned Session. I just want to say something on that and I'll pass it on. I think Session is a great alternative. For those who know Rob Braxman, the privacy guy, he recently did a good video on that. I recommend checking out things like Session and Status. But then Ramiro even recommends XMPP, which is a protocol, a little bit more even like in your hands, in your control. It's really about the options you choose. I wouldn't say any of these digital tools should be trusted 100% if you're really doing something illegal that you're worried about somebody, you know, finding. But it is important to practice privacy for the sake of privacy. Some people say, well, I'm not doing anything wrong, Derek. Why would I? Who cares if they're on WhatsApp? Well, if you don't practice privacy, you lose it, right? You can still be just telling your wife what you want her to pick up from the grocery store, but you're using Session or Signal or XMPP, some private tool, right? Because you want to exercise that right. So, yeah, and I'm sure we got more opinions on this panel as well. So we'll hear from them.
You got some, David?
Yeah, I think the First of all, yes, it is difficult and confusing, and it's equally confusing for us. So there are all these different protocols, and we're, you know, I mentioned earlier that we're kind of drowning in tools, and we have all these different tools that we can use. And they all are, you know, built for different reasons and by different institutions. And a lot of them are funded by government because the government's printing money, literally, so they can fund all this stuff. And they need to use privacy as well. They need to use secure communications as well. The key point that you mentioned, Derek, that I'd like to focus on is open protocols.
Yeah.
So this is this idea that you have a protocol just means a way of doing things, right? So we have these open ways of doing things that we can all agree on. We look at them. We know exactly how they work. And if we can start using those amongst each other, then that's going to be our best way of doing it, because we don't have to depend on a third-party server. We don't have to depend on a company or an institution that needs to be funded to run those, as long as we're running them all ourselves. The problem is, and the confusion enters, is that, you know, folks aren't jumping from Facebook Messenger to XMPP and Matrix Protocol. It's just not happening. There's this sort of huge in-between. Where, you know, things like WhatsApp and which was great until Facebook bought it. In my opinion, it was, you know, okay. Signal, you know, again, pretty good. We understand the encryption they're using, but we don't know for sure what they're running on their servers. So there's a degree of trust there that that is required. But these tools are good intermediaries. They're approachable. They're easy to use, and you don't want to make perfection the enemy of good, right? So if you can get, for example, my whole family is willing to use Signal. Great. They are not willing to use Matrix yet. You know, maybe they will one day. Maybe they never will, and maybe that's the way it is. But we're kind of moving this direction, right? So I remember when I first learned about and started using Signal for the first time. It was actually two applications: one for text called Text Secure, I think, and the other was the phone, which was called Red Phone. And it was garbage. It didn't work very well at all. The only person that I could convince to use it with me was my girlfriend, and I kind of forced, you know, there's a little coercion involved, like, come on, just use this thing with me, you know. So we're working our way towards this distributed model where we are in control of the infrastructure entirely. And when it comes to the protocols, the networking protocols like Tor, sometimes it has to do with the way you're using it. If you're using Tor for your general web browsing and you're going to what we call ClearNet or .com.org.net, your ClearNet websites, you're actually exiting the Tor network into the clear, and you have to use a Tor exit node to do that. And a huge percentage of those exit nodes are run by Alphabet agencies. And so that traffic is easily correlated and timed and can be used to identify you. But if you're staying within the Tor network and you're visiting Tor hidden services, which are dot onions, and they're very long, they're actually public keys. They look like Bitcoin addresses. That's a lot more secure. Now, are there attacks within that network? Yes, it's still not a perfect network. And there's other networks, I2P. And, you know, it's a journey of where we're at, where we're going, you know, what we're willing to compromise on, usability, the UX around these tools, especially the more distributed stuff is a lot more difficult. And that's what we're working on every day. So don't get overwhelmed. Use what you can get other people to use, you know, and what tool works best for you. And, you know, always keep your eye out and be listening and do your own research and understand what the possibilities are for the future.
Right on. Do you want to add something there, Glenn?
Sure. So we know what not to use, right? We know to stay away from Facebook, WhatsApp, all of that stuff. So the question was really good. And then, you know, there's the other end. It's the sliding scale again. The other end is, okay, we can be totally private, but no one else is using that, yep, that thing. So, okay, this is good. Signal, there's a lot of other people using Signal right now. And if you're using Signal and you want to connect with somebody, okay, well, they're probably using Signal. So it's a good way to move it to. Session is a good one, because Session is good for if you don't want to give people your phone number, and if you want to just, you want to communicate with a stranger or something like that, you can share a barcode or something like that. Session is really good too. So anyway,
I just want to add, the best privacy technology that we all have right now, you don't even need a phone to use it, nor do you need to download anything. It's called our mouths. And that's why we emphasize and overemphasize the importance of establishing in real life human connections. Because if you're really spreading the man and doing some nefarious counter economy stuff, the best policy is to do it in person.
Can I ask that real question?
Yeah, go. You got some, Derek?
Yeah, I just want to add to that. We're actually we're almost at Ramiro Romani, so we got maybe time for one more question. But I did want to just emphasize what you said there. And the gentleman who asked the previous question, he also was like, well, why are we all using Telegram? And for those who have looked, you know, one of the, if not, I think the main founder is listed as one of the World Economic Forum contributors. We don't really know exactly what the nature of that relationship is, but people are skeptical of Telegram. But regardless of the specific digital tools, as David and Glenn were saying, and as John was emphasizing there, the whole point is to meet in person. So, for example, we have the Mexico Freedom Cell on Telegram. You can search that. There's Texas Freedom Cell. There's so many of them. And then there are Freedom Cells on our website. But whether you're finding people through the website or you're using Telegram to form your groups or Signal or Session or Status or XMPP or any other thing like that, the whole goal is to leave that behind. At least with our movement, Freedom Cells, we're trying to bring people together. So, for example, someone was asking about the Morelia Freedom Cell. We have a local Freedom Cell on Telegram, but it's basically just a public group, right? And that's just where we post upcoming events. And then we have an inner circle for the people who actually show up and get involved, right? So it's important, I think, to have those kind of barriers and those protections. So maybe you do have public groups where people who can hear about the work you're doing, they find you through that. But that's not real. Where the real work is happening. The real work is happening face-to-face, in person with people, right? So just remember that too. We don't have to give all of our information to the digital tools. We can use them as intermediaries to finding the people we actually want to work with.
Word. Cool, cool. All right, I got one more question. I'm going to step over here on camera there and unveil your privacy. Go ahead.
All right, thank you guys. I just had a question as far as the privacy goes, you know, and keeping things away and off of the internet is probably the best way. But as far as the hardware and technology, we've learned that a lot of these technologies have come funded from the government, and in general, military and private technology and hardware is generally about 30 to 40 years estimated above what's available privately. So what are your guys' ideas for the future and keeping pace with, you know, these ideas that, you know, the encryption could be hacked by brute force quantum computers somewhere, you know, in a classic Donald Rumsfeld sense? What's the sense of the unknown unknowns as far as the battle against privacy?
Let's start with Parasite on that one. I think he's got a lot of experience with that.
I'm very bearish on quantum computing and actually it being something viable. It just costs really a lot of money to do anything valuable. But it's also not improbable that it will happen in the next decade or something like that. But there are also a lot of researchers working on post-quantum cryptography and hybrid cryptography, which part of it is not quantum resistant and part of it is. But I don't think we should move all of our focus into this post-quantum world, because we still have a lot of ways to go until something like that happens. About the government funded things, I don't think it's a big deal very often, because even with Signal and Tor, which everyone is scared about because they're being funded by the government, you should try to find somebody you know and somebody you trust that understands the cryptography behind these protocols, and they can actually explain to you that it works well and that it's actually secure. I know it's very difficult for most people to understand these protocols and the way things work, but you should connect with some more experienced people, and they can really explain what's going on behind it, and hopefully in a simple way. I can do that as well. If you message me privately, I'll show you very nicely how Tor and how Signal work.
Right. Thank you.
All right, you got something to add, David?
Just saying thank you. And I think he's right. That is important to get some tips from people who are more knowledgeable. A lot of this info, I've seen some heads scratching today. I know a lot of it might go right over some of our heads, myself included. But this is why we bring these guys here who have the knowledge and the experience to try to break these things down to you.
Yeah. Go ahead, David.
Yeah, I was just going to agree that this idea of it's like a cat and mouse game, right? So every time that the someone comes up with some super expensive tool and they engineered it specifically to break this specific thing, it's like, okay, that's great, but we've also been building this other thing because we thought you might do that, right? So we're just going to go over there now.
Yeah.
So
yeah, precisely.
This is always happening. There's always this evolution. The one thing that really keeps me, like, I've been really pessimistic for a lot of the past of my life, and even now I have some short-term pessimism, but in the long term I'm very optimistic because of the human ingenuity that goes into any project, any tool, right? So, like, you know, people are guerrilla gardening, right? They're planting seeds just all over the place. Like, what technology are they going to use? They're going to send robots out to uproot all these? No, it's not feasible. Yeah. And keep in mind that while they're powerful, these guys are in control of these global monetary systems. There's really not that many of them. A lot of their power is an illusion. This is a very Wizard of Oz thing, yeah, right? So when we pull the curtain back, it turns out it's just these old guys that say, you know, maybe you should eat some bugs. You know, they're not actually that terrifying, and they require the brilliant minds of humans that generally want to do good, right? So, you know, I guess the overall point is, again, that we're always creating new solutions. And so when they come out and they, well, we have a quantum computer now that we haven't told you about for 20 years and we can break everything as far as standard encryption. Well, first of all, that's all your bank accounts. That's how the internet works. So all that stuff's broken too. Never mind Bitcoin and these new protocols. But furthermore, as mentioned earlier, there's also quantum resistant encryption schemes as well. So all this stuff is constantly being improved and iterated upon.
Yeah.
Do you want to add, Glenn?
No, I think that.
Okay, cool. There was a picture circulating of Klaus Schwab, Justin Trudeau, and the new prime minister in Great Britain. And I just wanted to show it real quick, just to show you guys that we shouldn't really be worried about these clowns. These are the guys everyone's afraid of here. And wow. If you ask me, I think they're just a bunch of dorks. So I guess maybe with that, we could...
Thank you, Parasite. Thank you, everybody, for being with us for this panel. Let's give them a round of applause, everyone.
Thanks, guys.
Are you sick of being told you will own nothing and be happy?
Are you sick of being told how to live your life by the mainstream media?
Exactly what people think. And this is extremely dangerous to our democracy.
Are you exhausted with the truth community, focusing only on the problems?
Are you ready to do something about it?
Let's take action together. Join the Freedom Cell Network in January 2023 as we return with the Greater Reset for co-creation.
The Greater Reset is a 5-day in-person and online gathering where solutions-focused speakers and organizations share practical steps for individual and collective liberation.
This year, we'll even hear experiences from real communities on the ground across multiple continents.
The Greater Reset 4 will focus on activating 5 focus areas over 5 days.
January 18th, liberate your mind, body, and soul.
January 19th, permaculture and food independence.
January 20th, agorism and parallel networks.
January 21st, take back our tech.
January 22nd, building free and conscious communities.
This is our time to co-create the world we want for 2030 and beyond.
Join us as we lay the foundation for the next stage of a free humanity.
Join us from January 18th to the 22nd, 2023, as we gather online, in person in Central Texas and Morelia, Mexico.
Join us for the Greater Reset 4 co-creation.
View the full speakers list and organize your local activation hub at thegreaterreset.org.